Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm very glad you could join us today. We're talking about a recent spate of building collapses in Baltimore. The first was on a warm day at the end of March. A West Baltimore man named Thomas Lemon was sitting in his car, a pretty nifty Cadillac, in a vacant lot. Family members say he liked to sit there and listen to music. Out of nowhere, the building next door collapsed, burying Thomas Lemon's car in rubble. Two boys who were at a playground nearby described what happened to WBAL.
We heard a big boom,
and I came over here and just started helping taking the bricks off.
It was sad because the way how he was in the car and how I smashed him. And he didn't do nothing to nobody. He was a cool person.
Thomas Lemon died at the hospital shortly after the accident. The following weekend, at least four more houses collapsed in high winds. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake said she has quadrupled city investment in tearing down vacant and blighted properties, but recent events indicate that investment is either misdirected or insufficient. Michael Braverman, the city's deputy housing commissioner for code enforcement, has joined us to talk about what the city is doing to prevent vacants from collapsing. And later in the hour, we'll hear from Edward Erickson, Jr., a staff writer for Baltimore City Paper, and Carol Ott, director of Housing Policy Watch, better known for funding the blog Baltimore Slumlord Watch. She'll also be joining us. First, producer Andrea Appleton visited the site of several of the recent collapses yesterday and spoke with neighbors. The first voice you'll hear is a woman named Rose. She lives three houses down from a building on Payson Street that blew over in high winds last weekend.
The wind, it was real loud, crackling and everything, so the wind was extremely horrific. So we didn't hear anything. We didn't know anything, as a matter of fact, until the next morning. This house that just fell down has been vacant for about at least 20, 25 years. And these two houses are vacant right here. So it's, and then this one right here next door to me is vacant. So yes, we're all worried about it. Kids will be kids, so of course they walk down the sidewalk. They're up and down, and they're playing around in the area and everything. So we are, you know, concerned about that as well. And we've been around here for about 52 years. At one time, it was a really nice neighborhood.
I live in this block. 1500 block. I saw the fire department up there Sunday, and then I knew what had happened, you know, because I saw them picking up, I guess, bricks.
And what did you think?
Oh, another house blew down. I hope nobody lived in there.
So apparently when there was a storm or a wind, it just collapsed, and it just happened that I was here. So when I turned around to drive home, I was over there, and I saw, you know, the debris are, you know, all over. Well, it sounded, you know, like boom, you know, a big boom. There are so many, you know, boarded houses in this area, and it's not good for the landowners like me. People don't even want to rent. It takes me like 6 months, 8 months to rent the place. You know, there is a burned house next to my house, and I have a hard time.
And were you surprised to see them falling down?
Not really. One day it's going to fall because you can't tell. You know, it is just very sad. I don't know why the city doesn't do anything.
Those were the voices of two residents of North Payson Street, where a building collapsed over the weekend, and a landlord who owns several buildings in the 1700 block of North Fulton Street, where two more houses collapsed. She identified herself only as Almaz. Michael Braverman, Deputy Housing Commissioner for Code Enforcement, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So you heard Almaz. She wants to know why the city didn't attend to those decrepit houses sooner. How would you respond to her?
Well, first of all, can't take anything away from the circumstances of living in Baltimore City, in communities with extraordinary concentrations of vacant and abandoned buildings. And it's a significant capital dollar problem that legacy cities like Baltimore, Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo are struggling with. You know, unfortunately, we're in an environment where you know, it's not likely we're going to get the help from the federal government that we need to capitalize the kinds of approaches that we need to take to manage this kind of inventory in Baltimore, which, you know, in the big picture is a result of, you know, 50 or 60 years of macroeconomic changes, a city that went from close to a million to its present population of 620,000, a job structure that changed dramatically. And we have, as a result, a huge concentration of vacants. We have, you know, look, the mayor, Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, has committed some significant increase in funds for demolition, and the governor and our partners in the state legislature have committed significant additional funds. The conversations I think we had on your show, Sheila, in the past have been, to some extent, about how that money gets spent strategically. And I think that conversation has been had about how to do whole block demolitions to stabilize adjacent blocks and to leverage investment. That's a separate discussion and question from, I think, what the individuals you interviewed were talking about, which is not, you know, how do we approach the larger capital dollar problem of vacants in Baltimore City, but how do we ensure public safety at the same time? And I think that, you know, the buildings that came down, you know, were subject to extraordinary stresses and weather conditions. Some of these vacant buildings, you know, are going to pose a danger that they wouldn't otherwise. And I think that is something that we have to sort of rededicate efforts to look at. And we're doing that now. I mean, the commonality with those buildings essentially is that they were ends of group structures. And we're analyzing every single vacant end of group structure right now. And we will inspect every one of them over the coming weeks. And we will analyze them and apply, you know, a different standard that will take into account, you know, unpredictable weather conditions and do what we can to minimize the risks that that we just heard folks in the community are concerned about.
Let me pick up on a couple of things, because you seem to be saying that there's been, and we of course have followed the news, of attention to a strategy for getting rid of at least some of the vacants. As you mentioned, the governor's plan seemed to focus on whole blocks at a time that could be demolished. And you're saying that's separate from looking at the most fragile, the most derelict buildings. But it also sounds a bit as if you have not, the city has not been intensively looking at these very fragile structures. The Baltimore Sun, as you know, reported this week that there are about 500 vacant houses in the city. The city considers at such risk of collapse that city inspectors examine them every 10 days. I'm assuming that's accurate.
Yeah. So, but the point is that we are aware of those buildings and we do monitor them. So the public safety issue is first and foremost, and a separate issue from sort of what the budget is to deal with the larger capital problem of vacancies across the city. We try to keep that separate from the issue of protecting public safety.
But is there separate money to address them? Or if it's the same pot of money, one has to be a priority, no?
Yeah. Anytime. So the purpose of those inspections, 10 days, is to determine whether if there's an imminent danger, means the danger of imminent collapse that could happen within the next 24, 48 hours. Imminent is the term, and then irrespective of the budget, they will be demolished.
Okay.
So there's two separate tracks. You know, there's one keeping an eye on the buildings to protect public safety, and another is, you know, that's not the bulk of our vacant buildings are not in imminent danger of collapse. So there's, how do we deal with that problem? And that's a huge capital dollar problem. But it is never a capital dollar issue about protecting the public safety.
Well, what is the city spending in a year to make these accelerated inspections, these inspections every week or 10 days of buildings that have been identified as most at risk of collapse? What does that inspection program cost the city?
Yeah, it's not the inspection program that costs. It's the capital dollars that you're spending to do the demolitions, because we're dedicating several building inspectors to that, but we're spending probably on our emergencies and our constituent-driven work probably $2 to $3 million a year just on taking care of constituents and dealing with emergencies. And a lot of those, you know, the bulk of those aren't entire building collapses. They're, you know, buildings have fragile components that need to be addressed, porches and second-story additions and things like that. But that's about $2 to $3 million a year.
The buildings on that very fragile list of, as I said, the Sun reported about 500, and I think they got that number from you. So I'm assuming that's a good working number.
Yes.
How many of those are buildings the city itself owns?
You know, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I would tell you that we don't own the bulk of the inventory. We own a fraction of the inventory of vacant buildings in the city of Baltimore, maybe 2,500 out of the, now we're pushing about 17,000. So I assume that, you know, that list is probably representative in percentages.
Okay, so most of the buildings that are very, very fragile, on the verge of collapse, need inspections really often to try to make sure, although as we've seen in the last week and a half, it doesn't always work to get ahead of the forces of nature in destroying those buildings. Most of those are privately owned. So when the city identifies a building as really close to collapse, do you contact that owner? Do you say you got to step up and shore up that building or tear it down because it's going to kill somebody?
Well, there's a couple of things to talk about in those questions. The first is that, you know, the idea that there's a sort of a warm body behind all these vacant buildings, you know, is part of the, unfortunately, been part of the narrative for a while. But the reality is the bulk of, you know, we're down, like I say, 350,000 people. We got probably the census and the post office show are unoccupied at closer to 40,000. The 17,000 vacants we're talking about are a subset of those that are under our code, both unoccupied and unfit for human habitation in some way. Those are typically the board ups. And we didn't get that way because there's a warm body behind every one of those. A lot of people have died in 900 North Pace, and somebody, in fact, died who owned the building. And it became vacant subsequently. So there's not, you know, there often isn't a warm body associated with it. So what we're doing is, irrespective of ownership, we're going to take the building down if it needs demolition. And, you know, it's not likely that we're going to find somebody to repair the building. I mean, that would be sort of an unusual circumstance. So the program is organized to take action when it's necessary. I think the second point I just wanted to make is that, you know, you make a good point. If, in fact, you know, we're monitoring buildings, you know, and we've still seen some collapses, what do we need to do differently?
And what is that?
And I think to ask that question for your audience and to answer it squarely, it is that we there's a couple of things. You know, one is whether, you know, a building, you know, is the walls are true and plumb and not showing any signs of stress cracks, et cetera, you know, is we're going to be looking towards a new standard for imminent danger. You know, again, if it's a privately owned property and you want to take it down, there's a, you know, it's privately owned property and the city has to give the process that's due to an individual owner, even if they're no longer alive, even if there's no longer a warm body. We have to go through the process of identifying all parties in interest, giving notice, an opportunity for a hearing, and then conduct the environmentals that the city's required to do. And that's a several month process, and, you know, could be with no environmental remediation required. Could be still 4 months.
But what I don't understand is, can you short circuit that process if you identify a building as in imminent danger
of
collapse?
Right. So the if in fact you say no, this is an imminent danger of collapse, it's like fighting a fire. You don't need to get permission of the owner or a search warrant. You kick the door down and you fight the fire. So the standard of imminent danger, I think we need to adjust so that even if a building is true, like all four walls, and not showing any signs of stress cracks. But, you know, we can make the credible argument that a weather event, intervening weather event, could lead to an imminent collapse. Then we need to take summary action as if it was a danger that moment. You know,
Michael Braverman, Deputy Housing Commissioner for Code Enforcement, I've got you for just a few more minutes. Let me pursue a couple of just sort of basic things. How many vacants collapse in Baltimore in any given year? Like last year, for example, how many collapses?
Last year, there were, you know, again, not talking about fires or car running into it. We had
out of the blue collapses.
Yeah, 10 incidents of collapse in fiscal 15. I'm sorry, I'm talking in fiscal years, but that's all I got.
Okay, yeah, that's all you got is a fiscal year. Okay, 10. And was that sort of a typical year, do you know?
Well, fiscal 14 was 12. Fiscal 16 was 32.
Okay.
Already, and we're not done.
So this seems to be, for weather reasons or whatever, this is more active.
Yeah, we had, they're almost entirely related to the snow we had and the weather events that we had. And that's what I'm saying. What we need to do is look to a different standard of imminent danger. And so that's what we're doing right now.
How much does it cost to demolish a vacant?
They vary based on size, right? But just some rules of thumb: 14,000 for a two-story, 22,000 for a three-story. I would say about 14,000 for a two-story wall and 25,000 for a three-story wall.
And are those costs different when you do it on an emergency basis than when you've planned it?
The only additional cost is for the emergency call for the contractor. So it's about another 2,000. That's just tacked on to get your contractor there in 2 hours.
And so it actually is more expensive to respond to the emergency.
Slightly. I mean, as a percentage of the total job, not significantly.
Okay. But you said to me a few minutes ago that when you see it's imminent, you don't worry about the budget. You basically do
it. You don't worry about either the Constitution or the budget. The Constitution gives you the authority to do it immediately. But you have to establish that there was no time to give the notice and process that's due.
But does that money then come out of the same pool of money that you will use
organized demolition?
And does that change the way does that lead to any different conclusions about how to get ahead of the ones that are about to collapse?
No, I would say that, and I would speak, I think, on behalf of anyone who is doing their best to protect the public safety in a representative position. It is not a budget issue when it comes to public safety. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the budget is. We're going to have to spend whatever it takes. You know, and so...
I have to let you go in a minute, but I think people who have been watching this story unfold this spring, knowing it's not the first time that there have been these spates of collapses in the face of weather, they're like, why? If as you just said, we're going to have to do this no matter the cost. Once a building has been identified as very, very fragile, shouldn't it just come down no matter what? I mean, once it's at risk, that much at risk that you're inspecting, that you're visiting it every week or 10 days, isn't that the time to just say, never mind the cost, we have to get ahead of this? This building's going to have to come down at some point anyway.
So, well, the buildings that have to come down at some point anyway but are not in imminent danger, you know, those are not necessarily... You know, again, there's a lot of those buildings in the city, right? So it's we want to make sure that for all the buildings, the 17,000 vacant buildings, that we can be strategic about what needs to be demolished with limited demolition dollars. Again, a city shouldn't necessarily be in that position either. That's a larger issue of the fact that, you know, Baltimore hasn't been the beneficiary of, say, the $100 million that Detroit got for demolition from the federal government and the subsequent $100 million that they're going to get. But to your question specifically, when we're talking about imminent danger, it's how we assess the building. And, yes, imminent danger, down immediately. What I was saying to you was that I think that we are going to review all the end-of-group structures, every end-of-group vacant in the city. And we are going to argue a a more aggressive standard for imminent danger. So that will expand the pool of buildings we'll be able to take down summarily. And that's what we'll be doing over the next several weeks.
So you're doing that already. You're basically on that course already. So, but just one last question. How often you've got you know specific addresses of specific buildings that you think are very close to collapse, and you're keeping a close eye on them. Do any of those buildings ever come off that list?
Yes, sure.
In what way?
Well, it depends on the markets that they're in. I mean, if you drove over to the 300 block of East Landvale right now in Greenmount West, you'd see a building that's been braced. It wasn't much more than a front wall. It's been braced. But in that market, it will get absorbed for renovation. The market is strong, and it will get renovated. So they can come off the list through renovation and do in different markets around the city.
Michael Braverman, Deputy Housing Commissioner for Code Enforcement, I really do appreciate your taking the time to talk to us and answer some of these questions. And I wish you a lot of luck in what you're embarked on.
We care greatly about protecting the public safety, and we will see some extraordinary uptick in the number of demolitions of and of group vacant structures over the coming probably 30 and 60 days.
I hope we can keep in touch with you about that.
Please.
Thank you. Michael Braverman. We have to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about collapsing vacants. We'll talk to a journalist who's been following the story for years and to an advocate with suggestions for what needs to be done. What do you think? Is enough being done? Do you think, do you live near a vacant house that you worry may collapse? Give us a call. 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday. I am Sheila Cast. Over the last week and a half, at least five vacant houses in the city of Baltimore have collapsed. A West Baltimore man named Thomas Lemon was killed last month after rubble buried the car in which he was sitting. We're joined now by Carol Ott, director of the nonprofit Housing Policy Watch. She also writes or oversees the Baltimore Slumlord Watch blog. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And Ed Erickson, staff writer for the Baltimore City Paper. Welcome back.
Yeah, good to be here. Thank you.
So we're all listening carefully, I'm sure, to Michael Braverman, and you know this issue with a lot of depth, both of you. Did you hear anything that surprised you?
No, nothing surprised me.
No, I was not surprised.
I spoke with Braverman about this issue first in circa 2006, and he basically said some of the same stuff. Although in 06, he was saying that it wasn't a matter of money and that we did have plenty of money to do the demos, which was in contradiction to Jerome Dorich, who at the time had the line responsibility for these.
Jerome Dorich
was he was a guy in housing who had the line responsibility to handle emergency demolitions and collapses and stuff like that. And this is back 10 years ago. And what I said to Braverman is, you know, I asked him the same question you asked him. And his answer was, well, you know, you're not an engineer. You don't know when something's going to collapse. Well, they had already fallen down. You know, we had these spates of, you know, the wind blows 40 miles an hour and five buildings go down. We have these every few years. It's the same thing. And after I wrote about it then, what Braverman said was, well, you know, we're now going to start inspecting these things every week. You know, when we have a list
and
of
they,
these.
And they now say they have started inspecting them every week.
This was 10 years ago. You know, so you're looking at them every week, and yet they still fall down in bunches. So now he's saying, well, now we might have to have a different standard, you know.
For the ones at the end of a block.
We might have to have a different standard for what's imminent collapse. Well, listen, if 10 years ago you were telling me you didn't know then, and 10 years ago the inspector general told you, which they did, that you have to train your inspectors so that they know what the heck they're doing, all right, then why is it 10 years later the same thing is still happening? You're playing Russian roulette, right, with the citizens of Baltimore, aren't you?
Well,
I'm so unhappy I didn't get to talk to him.
Me too.
It was not our plan, but but we're making the best of the situation we have. are you basically saying, and Carol, let me direct this to you, Carol Ott. I mean, is it not realistic to be able to tell when a building is in imminent danger of collapse? Is it not possible to inspect a building and say 90% certainty this one's going to be okay, even in a high wind? Or 90% certainty this, and I just made up 90%. I'm not saying that's the standard. I'm just saying, is this inspections approach just not realistic?
I think if you work it backwards and you look at the standards that architects and builders are held to, I think, no, you can absolutely tell if a building is about to collapse. I mean, there are some super common sense things that you can look for just as a citizen walking by when something has only one wall remaining or two walls remaining. The roof is gone. I mean, when the parts of the building that are supposed to sort of keep it all together, the chimney, the roof, the joists are gone, it's, you know, you have a pretty good chance that building's going to collapse. But you know, like I said, there are standards for, you know, when you design and build a structure. So, you know, if architects and builders have to follow those standards, then there are people qualified to tell whether or not a building is in danger of collapsing from the time that it was built to years later. I think the problem is that you don't have people who are properly trained and qualified to make that determination.
Oh, so you think it's a competence question of the staff that the city is deploying on this?
We have some really good building inspectors. In fact, one of the inspectors who works in my neighborhood is excellent. But unfortunately, he is just one guy and doesn't go all around the city. So I think there are varying degrees of competency.
That was diplomatically said.
Let's back into the question from the other way, all right? Braverman began his spiel by saying this is a problem that a lot of, legacy cities have. Is that the word he used, legacy cities? So he's like, well, you know, in Boston and Cleveland and all these other places. Well, you know what? If you ask the people in Boston and Cleveland who'd handle this stuff, how many buildings collapsed in your city last year? The number's 2. The number's 3. In Baltimore, the number's 30, okay? He says to us, we're spending $2 to $3 million on emergency demos every year. Well, do the math. At 20,000 apiece, all right, that's 150 emergency demolitions. Now, a lot of these are...
Let me make sure I'm following. You're saying the money that we're putting into these souped-up inspections of the most...
No. This is what he said. He said, okay, we spend $2 to $3 million on emergency demolitions each year. He just told you that.
Yeah, I thought he was divide, also including the inspections in
put,
that.
All right, put 20,000 in to that. To that number, you get 150. Okay. Now, a lot of these aren't whole buildings because you know what? Ever since forever, the city doesn't take the whole building down. They take the porch off it or they take the chimney off it.
The stuff most likely collapsed.
Well, newsflash, the chimney is a structural element of these buildings. If you take the chimney off, the wall will fall down. Mm-hmm. 10 years ago, they were doing this. They're still doing it because they say, well, we want to save a little money. We'll spend $3,000 to take the chimney down. And then 3 months later, here comes P&J Contracting to take the rest of the building down. And they get paid, what, $2,500 extra because it's an emergency.
I believe you have reported that the cost, the per demolition cost, is higher now. I mean, lots of stuff is higher now, but you said there was a change when the city stopped doing its own demolitions and does it now through a contractor?
Well, it's P&J, it's Pless Jones, last I checked. And they would go for a while with Pless Jones, and they took it in-house, and they took it back out. And the price kept going up. And in ways, it's just like, well, it's hard to say why. And when I talked to Pless about this years ago, he said, well, you know, the tipping fees.
Pless Jones is a...
He's P&J Contracting.
Major contractor.
He's the guy who knocks down most of the buildings in the town for the city. And he said, well, you know, the tipping fee, we gotta pay to get rid of all this junk. And that price is going up at the landfills. And that was true then, and it's probably still true now. And I don't know. I haven't checked in this week about what the latest state of the art is. But the numbers that Braverman gave you, 14,000 for a 2 and 20 for a 3 in that neighborhood, 3-story building, that's, you know, that's in the ballpark. And then they paid, what did he say? He said about $2,000 more. Well, it was $2,500 more for an emergency demolition in 2010. So that's 10% more, at least.
I want to get into something that I deliberately did not pursue with Braverman because I think it's very complicated, but I'm counting on you two to make it crystal clear to us, and that is the complicated ownership of so many of these vacants. You've both looked into the ownership of the I think it was the one on Payson Street that collapsed.
The one on Payson Street that collapsed and killed a man while he was sitting in his parked car.
Right. Okay. So who owned it?
Well, it depends on who you ask, but my personal assessment is nobody. The property is currently in limbo due to a large loophole in the tax sale law that basically allows the tax lien purchaser to never take title to the home if they choose not to.
So this is very difficult for anyone who's not a tax lawyer, I think, to understand how you can own the house but not really own it or not really be responsible. I mean, is the tax sale purchaser responsible for that house? And if that house collapses, is that tax sale purchaser legally responsible for?
If they foreclosed on the lien and removed any rights that the previous owner once had, and if they pay all the additional money owed, and if they take the deed to the house, then yes, they then become the actual owner.
If all those steps are not followed,
they're not obligated to do all that.
Yes.
They have the option to do that if they want. So if the house is worth something, they might. But if it's not,
they're not going to.
Yeah, so this is part of what is, I think, challenging to understand about this whole situation is, why are people buying derelict houses? Why is an investor interested in buying these properties?
Well, there's, you know, some people go into it with the best of intentions. Perhaps they watched a few shows on HGTV and figured that, you know, hey, I can do that. And then I can flip it and I can make money. Or they watched, you know, late night TV and they saw an infomercial, you know, how to get rich quick by flipping houses. So there's that guy who thinks, okay, this is a good thing I can do.
And they're actually thinking that they may renovate this house.
Oh,
they
yes. They're thinking this
at least stabilize it.
Oh, yeah. This is going to be the greatest thing. I can quit my job, you know, make millions. But then you have people who sort of have the same goal in terms of making the millions, but in an unscrupulous way. So they will take title to the house under an LLC.
A limited liability corporation.
Exactly. So they'll take title to the house under an LLC, form a new LLC. One LLC flips the house to the other one, raising the price maybe by a few thousand dollars.
So the price on paper goes up. Mm-hmm. What does that do for anybody?
Because then what happens is you have some sucker who comes along and says, oh, I'd like to buy this house. Well, now you can raise the price even more and sell it to that guy. And so you've taken your $2,500 house and now maybe it's worth $6,000 because you flipped it between your different LLCs. Then you have a guy who's willing to pay you another $2,000, $3,000 on top of what you paid, thinking that he's going to be able to flip the house. Now, when you look at it in just in terms of one home, it doesn't sound like a whole lot of money. Nobody's going to go through all this trouble for an additional $4,000. I mean, I certainly wouldn't. But when you're talking about large-scale tax sale purchases, and when people...
Bundles of properties.
When people own hundreds of properties, and you're talking about an additional $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 over and above what you actually paid for it, that's a lot of money. It can run into the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
We need to take another short break here, and there's obviously lots more to talk about with Ed Erickson of City Paper and Carol Ott of the nonprofit Housing Policy Watch. And we're interested in your ideas. There's already some folks who want to be part of this conversation. Are the owners, in your view, are the owners of vacant buildings most to blame, or does the owners for preventing these collapses rest on the city? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8777. 1-800-273-8080. I'm Sheila Kass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Sheila Kast. I'm speaking with Ed Erickson, staff writer for the Baltimore City Paper, and Carol Ott, director of the nonprofit Housing Policy Watch, about the vacant row homes that seem to be collapsing right and left in Baltimore lately. You can be part of this conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us 410-662-8780. Janet has called from Pikesville with a question. Janet, welcome to Midday.
Hi.
Hi.
I called in a couple of months ago about the collapsing houses that we see on our senior bus trips when we go down through the city. But I was wondering if there's a lot of row houses in Baltimore City, and if you live in a row house and you keep your house up very well, but the house next door to you is in danger of collapsing or does collapse, how does that affect your structure or your property value?
Janet, I appreciate the question. Ed, you've been covering collapsing row houses for a decade. What's the short answer to Janet's question?
In Baltimore, if the house next to you is falling down, you're kind of screwed. I've done a number of these cases where people will call me and say, the house next to me is falling down. It's tearing my house down with it. I've called 311 X times. You know, we've been talking to the city for a year. In one case back in, like, I think it was 08, I went to this lady. She had this beautiful place. Next door was coming down. The porch fell off it. The city came out finally about 8 months after the porch had fallen off it, and that's when they did their emergency demolition of the house next door. So it was an emergency 8 months later. Again, you know, ka-ching, $2,500 more for, I think it was probably Pless Jones at that time, too. So the problem is, yeah, you don't have a lot of recourse. This woman had pretty much no recourse. She had water coming in, damaging her house, and that's a pretty typical story. You see that all over.
The water coming in through a missing roof or a deteriorated roof.
The house next door is open to the elements, and it'll come down right on her party wall, you know, through the bricks or whatever.
Janet, thank you for calling. George from Baltimore, I think, maybe in that situation. George, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, thank you, Sheila, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
And I called. I live on Remington Avenue, and I live next door to a vacant property. The whole block has been rehabbed by a company called Seawall. The owner of these properties, she's never lived in either one of them, but she comes there daily. The city has been and repaired the property next to me. They've already repaired the wall because it collapsed, I think, last year. You know, and I keep telling them it's in imminent danger of falling, you know, that's a falling down. And part of the party wall is gone. I heard the gentleman mention that about if there's no roof, then the water just goes straight down through the house. I had my roof done, and I had part of that roof done to eliminate that water coming in my sidewall, but it was just too late. So the party wall is gone, about 5 foot of it. And that wasn't too encouraging for me to hear him say, I'm just screwed. You know, I've lived in my house for 26 years, you know, and I have a nice house. And I don't know what to do. I have homeowners insurance, you know, but I don't know what to do about it. I've been to court many times, same thing. I've been dealing with this individual property owner for over 26 years, from the first day I moved in this house.
So the same owner next door.
Yeah.
The whole time you've been in your house, and
yeah.
So you know who this owner is.
Yeah, and the city knows too.
Yeah, and your house would be worth so much more if the house next door were either gone or in some kind of decent shape. You're getting ripped off left and right here by this.
And is there, Carol Ott? Is there what would you suggest to George?
Well, I feel really bad for George and the folks who are in the same predicament. Because George is actually one of the lucky ones because he still has homeowners insurance. A lot of people have their policy canceled by their insurance issuer because of the conditions of the home next door and how that house is affecting their house. So I'm honestly surprised to hear that poor George still even has insurance and they haven't canceled on him.
Oh, my gosh.
George, have you made a claim? Is he there, I wonder?
Yeah. No, I've never made a claim.
There, that's why you still have insurance.
Yeah, there you go. That's.
Oh, man, I feel bad for you, man.
I do, too.
You don't deserve this.
It really does sound like nobody deserves this. But Carol Ott, is it since George has not succeeded in court in.
Which I don't understand why he hasn't succeeded in court.
Right. That, if the owner's identifiable, you should be able to get a judgment at least.
George, I really do appreciate your bringing this to us, and I wish we had some happier reaction to it. It sounds like a big problem, and I'm sure it's a problem that you're not alone in. And I guess my question to you, Carol, is the city ultimately responsible if a homeowner like George, who's keeping up a house, is faced with a recalcitrant neighbor who is not keeping up the house? I mean, should we think of this as a problem of irresponsible homeowners, or is this the city's problem?
I think in George's case, and in the case of a home that collapsed in my neighborhood, damaging the occupied home next door, I think in those cases that perhaps the city should be handed a larger measure of accountability simply as an enforcement issue. I mean, when you've been told that a problem exists enough times and you don't do anything, then I think at some point you need to be held accountable for that.
One of the piece that Yvonne Wenger reported in the Baltimore Sun yesterday about the reaction of different candidates running for mayor to this collapsing vacant situation. Former Mayor Sheila Dixon said she would, if elected, she would create. I'm trying to get the phrasing in front of me, that she would create develop an inventory of vacant houses and categorize them by those that should be restored and those that should be raised. Does that inventory not already exist?
That's exactly what was done 10 years ago when she was mayor last time,
yeah,
when Braverman told me they did. And it does exist. I'm sure that exists.
It absolutely exists.
And to be fair to the city, I mean, it's true that if you had to do all this right away, the capital expense would be tremendous. It's on the order of $400 million, okay? We find the money otherwise somehow, and I think of it this way, right? If a hurricane or an earthquake had hit the city and left these buildings in the state they're in, what would happen, right? The mayor would say to the governor, hey, we got an emergency here. This is a disaster area. We need help.
That was the very first phrase that Michael Braverman responded to me with. He said, it doesn't look like we're going to get federal money.
He said there's no federal money coming, but that's because they don't see it as an emergency in a disaster area, which is what it is. It's just it happened over 50 years instead of over 50 hours.
But so I take your point, and that is perhaps something that should be discussed more than it has been. What has been discussed is a big infusion of state money. I know there's some question of how much, but Governor Hogan's proposal for a Project Core demolition, Michael Braverman presented that as very much a separate track.
It is.
Strategic demolition of whole blocks.
Yeah, that's to give land, clean land to developers. That's a whole different thing.
And that, I guess that's my question, is should it be a whole different thing?
Of course it shouldn't.
Should the collapsing vacants be the priority of that infusion of money?
I think anything that is so negatively affecting the residents in these communities should be the priority. I think people like George should be the priority. So instead of tearing down an entire block of crumbling houses that, let's say, they were to topple over, how many people could potentially be harmed by that? And if it's one or more, then that needs to be the priority, particularly when you have a block of homes, all of them are vacant except maybe one or two. That should be a priority. You have tax-paying homeowners who live on some of these blighted blocks.
Mike is calling us with I think, an idea for help for George. So, Mike in Baltimore, can you quickly tell us what you think George could do?
Sure. Well, and I would think that Carol and perhaps the other guests would know some of this, but just obviously there are no easy answers, and the question is to network. Now, there's an agency that you can find in the phone book called Strong City Baltimore, that has a code enforcement specialist who consults. He doesn't have a magic wand, but can offer could offer George possible support. In fact, this fella has offered his own individual monitoring and support for problem properties we have in our neighborhood. And also, I would point out the Community Law Center is developing a citizen action group called Renew Baltimore that's looking for people who are interested. Now, that may not address George's situation. Renew Baltimore is an attempt to be a citywide agency. Strong City Baltimore is more North Central Baltimore. And, you know, I mean, there are no easy answers, but
Mike, I appreciate the suggestions. We're short on time, so I'm going to thank you for those. And Carol, before we're completely out of time, what are your suggestions for what needs to be done to prevent future collapses? Have we covered it, or is there something more?
I think really the main issue for me is to close the loophole for tax sale purchasers. And
in other words, to make them, as soon as they purchase the tax liability, they're responsible for the whole they're responsible if that building collapses.
I think that there needs to be greater accountability, and I think there needs to be a lot less ability on their part to just sort of throw up their hands and walk away and not take title to the house or not take any responsibility for what happens to it during the 2 years that they're lollygagging around
trying to work it out through the courts. Ed Erickson, in 30 seconds, is there a closing thought that you think people should take away from this conversation?
You know, I absolutely concur with what Carol just said. She's right on the money in terms of how these houses become a problem that's much more difficult to solve than if it were a house with a good title, either in the city's name or somebody else's. So that's a huge part of it, I think.
I really am grateful to both of you for helping us understand this better, and I hope we can keep talking to you about it, because it is clearly an important issue that's not going away. Ed Erickson, staff writer for Baltimore City Paper, thank you.
Thank you.
And Carol Ott, director of the nonprofit Housing Policy Watch, thanks.
Thank you.
Early in the hour, we spoke with Deputy Housing Commissioner for Code Enforcement, Michael Braverman. I also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guests today. Eddie's is a full-service market, locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli has unique sandwiches and salads and specials each day, all on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. I hope you'll be back with us tomorrow. We're going to talk about the newest research by climate scientists of how fast sea levels are rising and what that means for Maryland. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.